Chapter 11. Recriminalizing Vote Buying. Nor shall any person holding any office of profit or trust under the United States or any of them accept any present emolument, office, or title of any kind. Articles of Confederation, 1777. If access to political power in a democracy becomes purchasable, governments turn into bazaars made up not of elected officials who govern according to law, but of entrepreneurs who sell their wares to the highest bidder. David Crossland, Berliner Zeitung, February 2010. It is the most famous presidential speech in American history. Lincoln's Gettysburg Address is lionized by historians. It eloquently consecrated the sacrifice of the thousands of American sons, brothers, and husbands who fell on the battlefield. But Lincoln's 272 words were not only a moving tribute to the fallen. He also sought to resurrect the foundation of the nation set forth in the Declaration of Independence by the Second Continental Congress. Indeed, the Republican Party emerged in 1854, built on Abraham Lincoln's intention. Gary Wills, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian, explains that Lincoln rejected the discriminatory, selective liberty embodied in the Constitution in favor of individual equality as the seminal inspiration and principle for American democracy. On that November afternoon in 1863, Lincoln spoke of lifting from the nation the dead hand of a Constitution empowering a slaveocracy and political inequality. Lincoln invoked the better angels in all Americans. But his call, like the 1776 vision of Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, John Jay, the abolitionists, advocates of women's rights, and others, would fail. The Jim Crow era, empowered by embarrassing Supreme Courts, would soon follow. Indeed, Lincoln's hope remains unfulfilled as you read this. Political equality has been repeatedly rejected by Buckley-era Supreme Courts in mimicry of the 19th-century Chase, Waite, and Fuller courts. American democracy is low quality because representatives neither fairly hear nor heed citizens. The Buckley genre sustains a criminalized political system that disrupts both the electoral integrity and representational equality that are central features of higher-quality democracies. Yes, there are additional factors contributing to America's poor quality of democracy, including the Electoral College and the severely malapportioned Senate. But ending the Buckley era is the crucial step. An epical reform that hinges solely on recomposition of the Supreme Court. That is a prerequisite for Lincoln's hope of individual equality to be realized. The Roberts Republicans may hope that their rulings have firmly placed the income bias at the center of American democracy, that the Buckley genre has definitively tipped the scales against original intent and two centuries of judicial precedent and jurisprudence. The late Justice Scalia asserted in Williams-Yulee v. Florida Bar, 2015, for instance, that pay-to-play is a settled First Amendment principle. Their hopes are certain to be thwarted at some point by judicial review. Episodes of abandonment of original intent like the Buckley era are not unusual in the history of the Supreme Court, whose dynamics are routinely influenced by personal preferences, events, better information, or turnover. In fact, the foremost conservative American jurist, Judge Posner, argues that the evolution in Supreme Court rulings regarding vote buying, especially after 2006, when Justice Samuel Alito replaced the retiring Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, underscores the question of the personal and political elements in judging, and thus of the sense in which the nation is ruled by judges rather than by law. It is ironic that the practice of judicial review utilized since 1976 to decriminalize vote buying is also the pathway for its remediation. The constitutional shield for corruption erected by the Berger, Rehnquist, and Roberts courts rests on quicksand, not original intent. The lottery of appointment and lifespan will assuredly produce at some future date a progressive Supreme Court majority willing to hew to original intent. That court can seek comfort by looking to rulings beginning in 1937, which began to balance the economics of labor and capital and bring life, finally, to the New Deal agenda. That and subsequent courts lifted the dead hand of economic Darwinism from Americans for nearly half a century, temporarily creating the grandest middle class in history. And a future one will have the rare opportunity, as historian James McGregor Burns wrote of the Earl Warren Court, to forge a luminous exception to the court's historic role as the bulwark of anti-democratic, anti-egalitarian conservatism. Indeed, Supreme Court turnover in the past has produced seismic new directions in national policy. Courts embracing Jim Crow and apartheid, beginning with the 1873 Slaughterhouse ruling, eventually gave way generations later to the Warren Court and its 1954 ruling in Brown v. Board of Education, reasserting the meaning and intent of the 14th Amendment. And a new court configuration will eventually install political equality and voter sovereignty by ending vote buying as the foundational principle of American democracy. The fittest 50 and small government conservatives have benefited disproportionately from the Buckley genre. But some conservatives are keenly aware that the Buckley era is on shaky ground, resting entirely on a court of dynamic composition. It was instructive that soon after the passing of Justice Scalia, the Koch behemoth began spending $42 million in attack ads against six Democratic Senate candidates, such as Ted Strickland, to successfully ensure continued GOP control of the Senate in 2016. The Kochs have reason to fear recomposition of the Supreme Court. Limits on campaign donations, including by foreigners and some military personnel, have been constitutional since 1867. Limits on political speech itself are commonplace in America, including fastidious rules for local government meetings, polling stations, state and federal legislative hearings, courtrooms, and the like. Moreover, Supreme Courts in the past have issued rulings explicitly to improve political equality, including Reynolds v. Sims, 1964, requiring one person, one vote. And then there is original intent. The Founding Fathers and the Framers sought to prohibit vote buying, determined to avoid the judgment of public officials being distorted by interested men bearing gifts or campaign donations. Acknowledging this original intent by recriminalizing vote buying to minimize corruption is the most compelling rationale within the American constitutional framework for ending pay-to-play. But there are other justifications, including maximizing political equality, enhancing electoral integrity, strengthening First Amendment individual speech rights, and removing the advantages afforded incumbency by pay-to-play to render voters sovereign by reducing the income bias. Each is a vital national interest. Minimizing corruption. The founders and the framers' concern with vote buying was a culmination of the anti-corruption themes in the writings of Plato, Edmund Burke, and Montesquieu, as well as the 1651 Dutch law forbidding even trivial gifts to public officials. The founders' intent was a sine qua non for states as they began writing their own charters and constitutions, and creating legislatures in the wake of the Second Continental Congress in 1776. In instructing the members of Congress scattering back to their states while dodging redcoats to lead these truly remarkable events, John Adams admonished, "Great care should be taken to effect this, and to prevent unfair, partial, and corrupt elections." Moreover, as noted in the introduction, unabashed opposition to corruption in any guise was written into the Articles of Confederation the Founding Fathers soon crafted. Nor shall any person holding any office of profit or trust under the United States or any of them accept any present, emolument, office, or title of any kind. The Founding Fathers could not have more forcefully provided future generations with clarity of their intent. A decade later, in 1787, the framers were equally adamant, exemplified by the concerns of James Madison and George Mason, noted in Chapter 3. That is why they included more than 20 anti-corruption provisions in the Constitution, more than any other topic. As in the Articles, their definition of corruption was all-encompassing. Constitution scholars like Robert Post have emphasized that the framers had an obsessive focus on indirect as well as quid pro quo corruption. Their definition of vote buying was perceived in the broadest possible terms, exemplified by their concern over King George III's suborning of parliamentarians. Royal grants were considered corrupting, regardless of whether any quid pro quo occurred. Indeed, even royal grants and emoluments to loyal Tory parliamentarians were viewed as corruption. Emphasizing this original intent, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor echoed the Founding Fathers' broad definition of corruption in her opinion in McConnell v. FEC, 2003, quoted in Chapter 7. Professor Zephyr Teachout explains their broadest possible definition this way. Delegates started their experiment in self-government committed to expanding the scope of the actions that were called corrupt to encompass activities treated as non-corrupt in British and French cultures. Buckley is incompatible with the traditional American theory of corruption. The Founding Fathers and the Constitutional Framers' criminalization of political bribery in any form and forum was soon reflected in state statutes. Public officials of the day were generally considered guilty of corruption when accepting support, even when their votes or behavior went unchanged. An 1816 statute in Georgia and similar laws that followed in Kentucky, Michigan, North Carolina, Minnesota, and other states went well beyond quid pro quo exchanges to quite broadly criminalize political donations of any kind. Teachout explains, for example, in Michigan, the briber was guilty if he gave something of value with intent to influence his public official's act, vote, decision, or judgment on any matter. Federal law later, Acts to Prevent Frauds on the Treasury, similarly criminalized political donations intended to influence a public official's vote or decision on any question before him in his official capacity or in his place of trust or profit. Colonial-era anti-corruption statutes expanded to keep pace with the ingenuity of favor-seekers, especially following the 1896 McKinley presidential campaign, which rather famously featured voluminous fundraising from corporate donors by Senator Mark Hanna. Within a decade, the Tillman Act, 1907, had criminalized such corporate political donations and independent spending as well. UCLA law professor Adam Winkler writes, "In the early 1900s, Congress and the majority of state legislatures adopted laws completely barring corporations from contributing money to candidates for public office. Included was Montana's Corrupt Practices Act of 1912, barring corporate political donations and spending by copper kings and other bribers. Enacted by Citizens Initiative, this law stood for a century until struck down by the Roberts Republicans in June 2012. Maximizing political equality. A second justification for ending pay-to-play is to place political equality at the center of American democracy, a concept viewed with hostility by Roberts Republicans. The opportunity for citizens to speak freely and for as long and forcibly as any other citizen should not be infringed by the fittest 50s ability to purchase television time or sound trucks to speak louder than their neighbors. As Justice Louis Brandeis concluded in 1920, protecting every citizen's speech rights enables and thus promotes direct involvement in government. Many American political scientists and some jurists nowadays place political equality at the center of their arguments that justify limits on political spending. For example, retired Justice John Paul Stevens believes it is the most compelling argument because with pay to play, the voter is less important than the man who provides money to the candidate. And Teachout joins legal theorists such as Cass Sunstein, Richard Hassan, David Strauss, and Kathleen Sullivan in arguing that the Buckley genre is designed to strip concerns of equality or inequality from campaign financing laws. Every other wealthy democracy has centered its governance model on political equality, marking it the global gold standard. Like the United States, free speech in Canada, for instance, is a constitutional guarantee. It exalts protections on speech content. But unlike the Roberts Republicans, Canada's Supreme Court has found that political equality is a foundational value to a high-quality democracy that justifies limits on speech volume. Over strident opposition from then-Conservative Prime Minister Stephen Harper, the Canadian Supreme Court held in the landmark ruling Harper v. Canada, 2004, that such strict limits on donations and independent political spending will create a level playing field for those who wish to engage in the election discourse. This, in turn, enables voters to be better informed. No one voice is overwhelmed by another. Individuals should have an equal opportunity to participate in the electoral process. That requires the wealthy to be prevented from controlling the electoral process to the detriment of others with less economic power. Judge Guido Calabresi of the Second Circuit Court agreed, writing in 2012, "If an external factor such as wealth allows some individuals to communicate their political views too powerfully, then persons who lack wealth may, for all intents and purposes, be excluded from the democratic dialogue. Contribution limits, like noise ordinances, still allow those who have the capacity a full opportunity to make their speech widely heard, but such limits make sure that this is done only in ways that leave room for everyone else to do the same." Calabresi makes a second point, that purchasable political speech lends itself to misjudgments in the intensity of feelings held by voters. To return to the example of the megaphone in the public square, the problem with its loudness is not just that it drowns out the voices of others, but also that it misrepresents, to an outside observer, the relative intensity of the speaker's views. The one speaker's relative loudness, along with the other speaker's relative softness, obscures the depth of each speaker's views, thereby degrading the communicative value of everyone's message. The ability to express one's feelings with all the intensity that one has, and to be heard, is a central element of the right to speak freely. Today, the amount of an individual's campaign contribution reflects the strength of that individual's preferences far less than it does the size of his wallet. Maximizing electoral integrity. Robert Post posits that electoral integrity is a more precise justification for limiting vote buying than political equality. The outcome is the same. In the absence of political bribery, public confidence in the democratic process is maximized, because representatives can thereby best hear and heed each citizen. In his book Citizens Divided, Post emphasized that it is paramount for each vote to be equally valued by representatives because political decisions are characteristically imposed on all. Maximizing individual First Amendment rights. A high-quality democracy features elected representatives who hear citizens' voices equally, or what Post and Justice Stephen Breyer term a sturdy political chain of communication. By providing a constitutional shield for unequal political voices, the Buckley genre diminishes the quality, vicissitude, and variety of speech being heard. That diminishes First Amendment rights, as Justice Breyer explained in his dissent to McCutcheon v. FEC 2014, quoted here at length. "The First Amendment advances not only the individual's right to engage in political speech, but also the public's interest in preserving a democratic order in which collective speech matters. What has this to do with corruption? It has everything to do with corruption. Corruption breaks the constitutionally necessary chain of communication between the people and their representatives. It derails the essential speech-to-government action tie. Where enough money calls the tune, the general public will not be heard. Insofar as corruption cuts the link between political thought and political action, a free marketplace of political ideas loses its point. That is one reason why the court has stressed the constitutional importance of Congress's concern that a few large donations not drown out the voices of the many." The majority opinion in Buckley argues that limits on the volume of political speech will disrupt the constitutional goal of promoting the unfettered interchange of ideas, diminishing free speech rights. By this illogic, it would seem that a soundtrack enhances the exchange of ideas, while its absence inhibits such exchanges. In actuality, political equality electoral integrity, and the chain of communication are enhanced by limits that preserve the free speech rights of each and every citizen, thereby strengthening an individual's First Amendment rights, as argued by Judge Calabresi. Unfettered political spending garbles the political debate, trumpeting voices that would otherwise be muted and muting voices that would otherwise be trumpeted. The only way to ensure a truly unfettered interchange of ideas, an interchange, that is, where each voice is heard in reasonable proportion to the intensity of the beliefs it expresses, is to give the government some freedom to mitigate the fettering impact of these inequalities. Maximizing electoral competition for incumbents. Justice Kennedy argues that limits on contributions and independent political spending is an incumbency protection plan. His contention is that such limits suppress well-funded challengers. Columnists such as George Will agree, writing that limits, rather cunningly, will be set by incumbent legislators to serve incumbent interests. George Will is correct. The limit favored by incumbents is infinity. And Justice Scalia argued that if incumbents and challengers are limited to the same quantity of electioneering, incumbents are favored. In other words, any restrictions upon a type of campaign speech tend to favor incumbents. These contentions by Kennedy, Will, and Scalia assume a fanciful vision of every challenger as a multimillionaire of pure heart, willing to bury larcenous incumbents with dollars. That stylized and vanishingly rare scenario is belied by facts. A domain of unlimited donations enhances the electoral prospects of incumbents. In virtually all elections, incumbents easily outraise and outspend opponents. They spend their careers pandering to donors, as the income bias documents, making them nearly invulnerable at the ballot box. Read on. The Buckley genre is the real incumbency protection plan. Evidence shows that making incumbents vulnerable requires corralling their monetary advantage by limiting electioneering spending, capping contributions, and capping independent political spending, while nurturing challengers with public funding. When limits are imposed in a fashion that equalizes electioneering resources, political competition is enhanced. Political scientists Kenneth Mayer, Timothy Werner, and Amanda Williams concluded in a Brookings paper, for instance, that the fear that spending limits would put challengers in an impossible strategic situation and make incumbents even more unbeatable has simply not been realized. Other scholarly analyses reached the same conclusion. Harvard Enching Institute scholar Ki-Hong Yeom and political scientist Donald Gross determined that donation caps reduce the advantage of incumbency. If anything, contribution limits can work to reduce the bias that traditionally works in favor of incumbents. A February 2013 analysis by George Washington University political science professor John Sides and Public Policy Institute of California research fellow Eric McGee examined the 2012 election cycle and concluded that incumbency provides about a 5 percentage points electoral edge. That advantage includes name recognition and at least a 2-year head start in raising donations, which is why Buckley has resulted in the typical congressional incumbent outspending opponents by almost 4-1. Consequently, more than 90% of Congress members are routinely reelected, including 97% of those seeking reelection in 2016. Elections are even less competitive at the state level, where 93% of incumbents typically win reelection. In a sentiment uniformly expressed by political scientists, University of Illinois professor Michael Miller notes that a career as an American legislator comes with a great deal of job security. Incumbents are practically unassailable. Most of the time, incumbents are able to bury challengers in campaign cash. The necessary factors to reduce this incumbency advantage are to limit contributions and independent political spending and equalize electioneering resources to all candidates. These are common practices in higher-quality democracies to ensure competitive elections by roughly equalizing resources to all candidates, as we learned in the previous chapter. Yet equalizing resources to ensure competitive elections are vigorously rejected by the Roberts Republicans. During oral argument on Arizona Free Enterprise Club PAC versus Bennett, 2011, for instance, Chief Justice Roberts asserted, "Well, I checked the Citizens Clean Election Commission website this morning, and it says that this act was passed to, quote, level the playing field when it comes to running for office. Why isn't that clear evidence that it's unconstitutional?" Evidence that political spending limits reduce the edge associated with incumbency comes from Arizona and Maine, states with the most seasoned public campaign funding programs in the United States. An analysis of these programs by political science professors Seth Maskett and Michael Miller in 2014 concluded that limits combined with public funding appear to manufacture quality candidates who might otherwise lack the attributes or experience to run viable campaigns. Documentation is also provided in a subsequent analysis by Miller in his book Subsidizing Democracy. Miller drew on more than 20 years of data and surveys from more than 1,000 candidates in states that limit electioneering spending while providing public funding to challengers. That combination creates more robust competition. In Arizona, for instance, the share of incumbents forced to confront major party challengers rose from 68% before public funding to 85% afterward. It improved the quality of that competition as well. Nearly 60% of candidates in public funding campaigns believed they were consequently more competitive. Miller writes, they cited public funding as vaulting them to a level of competitiveness that they would not have been able to achieve otherwise. The improvement in competitiveness is also suggested by a decline in electoral winning margins. The most expansive database bearing on the question of incumbency protection, political spending, and competition is from Albuquerque. Strict limits on donations and on electioneering spending existed there for several decades in municipal races, from 1974 until terminated by lawsuits based on Buckley in the mid-1990s. Its system also utilized public funding to equalize electioneering resources for candidates during these decades, providing a data-rich base. The first lawsuit challenging the Albuquerque donation limits induced a comprehensive assessment that has since been parsed by Richard Hassan. He noted that the court made a number of factual findings suggesting robust campaigning and widespread satisfaction with the system of candidate spending limits. That satisfaction certainly did not include incumbent mayors. The city's combination of public funding with caps on both donations and electioneering spending proved to be an existential threat to them. None was able to win re-election in these two decades. Hassan explained, in contrast to the nationwide incumbency rate of 88% for mayors, Albuquerque had a 0% incumbency rate in city mayoral elections held under spending limits. Many candidates spent less than the spending limits, and the 1997 winner spent less than $44,000 on his campaign. Candidate campaigns were vigorous and contested. Incumbents did not benefit, and perhaps may have been hurt, by spending limits. Voter turnout was higher than in other cities, and the public approved of the programs. The analysis also concluded that spending limits did not constitute censorship, with Hassan noting, the trial court's findings do not show significant government suppression of speech. Public surveys became another element of the Albuquerque record when provided in a separate federal district court lawsuit filing. The share of local respondents who believed that federal elections featuring unlimited political spending favored special interest money was well more than double the share believing that Albuquerque elections featuring limits favored such interests. The federal district court in Homans versus City of Albuquerque, 2001, concluded that 57% of surveyed Albuquerque voters think that federal elections are overly influenced by special interest money. In contrast, only 23% think that Albuquerque elections are overly influenced by special interest money. You have just read how best to begin restoring the faith of Americans in their democracy. Most Americans support recriminalizing vote buying. A Pew Research Center survey in 2015 found that 76% of Americans believe government is run by big interests, with only 19% believing that it is run for the benefit of everyone. A Bloomberg survey in September 2015 found 87% of respondents agreed that the campaign finance system should be reformed so that a rich person does not have more influence than a person without money. Results are similar in the joint New York Times-CBS News survey released in June 2015, noted in Chapter 2. Some 84% of respondents, including 80% of self-described Republicans, 84% of independents, and 90% of Democrats, believe money has too much influence in American politics. Respondents were critical of the Roberts Supreme Court, more than half rejecting any constitutional basis for the Buckley genre. Nearly 80% of them agreed that contributions and independent political spending should be capped. See chart 11.1. Overall, a remarkable 85% of respondents believed the pay-to-play U.S. political system requires fundamental changes, including 46% who agreed that it should be abandoned entirely. The system for funding political campaigns has so much wrong with it that we must completely rebuild it. Americans' preference to extinguish pay-to-play extends to corporate contributions and their political issue advertising as well. Supermajorities of Americans today would agree with President Theodore Roosevelt, writing in 1907 that all contributions by corporations for any political purpose should be forbidden by law. Directors should not be permitted to use shareholders' money for such purposes. Even business sector respondents agree. The polling in Demos, reported by Liz Kennedy, noted in Chapter 8, concluded that some 70% of business sector respondents to the 2012 Corporate Reform Coalition survey believe a ban on corporate-funded political ads would improve politics, and a majority was in favor of a constitutional amendment to ban all corporate contributions and political issue advertising. Those majorities include 57% of self-described moderates and also 57% of independents. If Citizens United cannot be overturned, respondents favored requiring full transparency, with corporate donor names released immediately. And corporate and CEO donor names should be prominently displayed in all advertising. The widespread dismay with Citizens United is bipartisan, indicated by citizens in relatively conservative Montana and the swing state of Colorado. Montanans in 2012 approved Initiative 166, which requires its congressional delegation to sponsor a constitutional amendment to prohibit corporate donations or spending in state elections. And some 74% of voters in Colorado in 2012 also supported a referendum calling for a U.S. constitutional amendment to reverse Citizens United. The referendum won in every Colorado county. Americans largely reject vote buying. Their knowledge that it remains widespread is certainly one of the primary factors responsible for their sense of political impotence and loss of faith in the nation's governance. The next chapter shows how this angst can be remediated by a national will to adopt the practices and electoral systems of higher quality democracies.